Such a speaker doesn't need an introduction, and such a topic also not. It's something that many people are wondering and interested in. Just to be Magdim, these days are days when Yidden are thinking about Zachreinu L'chaim, Melechovetz V'chaim, Chasreinu V'seifa V'chaim. It's times that we think about Chaim, we're mispalel about Chaim. It's brought down this one. They're planning for La'acher Chaim is a skule to have Chaim. When a person does what he can to arrange and settle things that should be outside of Yosef Toiv and Alpi Ha'aluche, that itself is a skule to tell the Baruch Shem, I'm trying to live my life as I should and as you want me to. To give all the geschos, it's hard times, it's not simple these days, traveling is not so easy as it used to be. You would come, you'd have a flight, and you'd go back. Today, you need a lot of siyata deshmaya, and Rabbi Morbiger is such a busy dayan over the world. He's brought and sought out after. It's a big schos that he gave us from his time to be able to come and teach us the right way how Yidna is supposed to be misnagged in these inyunim. So the Rebbein Shem help, we should all have a ksivah simetayra. I'd like to mention as well that Kenai Nahara, as for many years we had this chus of having the Simcha Davis legal holiday being sponsored by the Davis Mishpacha. The Shi'idim I enjoyed and appreciated, and we look forward in Yetz Hashem to be able to continue this Abutzis HaTayre Lili Nishmusai of the Davis Mishpacha, what they've done for so many years. Rabbi Morbiger.
It was late one night, a few days before Pesach, and a young Almana was cleaning the kitchen. She was struggling to move the oven when she noticed there was an envelope that was on the floor, wedged between the oven and the counter. She saw her name on it, in her late husband's handwriting, who had just recently been nifter, succumbed to a brief illness. She opens up the envelope, and she sees there's a note. And the note says, "Dear Rachel, if you're reading this, it means I'm no longer with you to help you. I know how hard it must be, the first yontif alone, without me there to help you prepare for Pesach. And I want to cheer you up a little bit. Please go buy yourself a piece of jewelry for Yontif." And it was signed by her late husband, and there were $2,000 of cash in the envelope. You can imagine how touched she was, and the next day, through the tears and the laughing and the crying, she was telling her family about what happened and what a beautiful story it was. When her brother tells her, "Wait a second, are you sure that this money really belongs to you? Are you allowed to buy yourself a piece of jewelry? Your son, you have a son. Your son, who's 2 years old, is a Yerush. Does such a letter have the ability, does that change the Seder HaYerusha? And does this money become yours? Perhaps it goes to Yerusha, perhaps belongs to your child, who's too young to be Michael, and you may not be able to spend this money. What's the halacha?" Now, before anyone gets too outraged about the story, let me assure you it never happened. But while this is a bit of a dramatic way of bringing out the point, we have other stories that happen each and every day. When people die without any estate planning, without any will, without any trust, without any tzava. And suddenly we're dealing with a tremendous challenge. Because there are people's, there is the law, how the courts will distribute the assets. There are the expectations of the family, and there's halacha. And very often, these three approaches have very different outcomes. And as we're going to see, a person that dies without any will, without any tzava, is creating a potential nightmare and catastrophe in the family. When each person goes ahead and has different ideas and different expectations, and each person will run to the venue that where they feel they will be best off. So while dying is not a popular conversation that people enjoy talking about, nevertheless, as we're going to see from today's shiur, how critical it is to, and how much you owe it to your family to do some level of preparation. So to begin, let's start with the Seder HaYerusha. If a person dies without any plan in place, no will, no trust, no tzavah, how are his assets distributed? Now every system of law, lahavdo, has to have some scheme how Yerusha should work. And every country has a slightly different plan of how it's distributed. And to a large degree, it reflects the values of society. Today in the United States, we're into equality, being treating everyone the same, boys, girls, husband, wife, everyone is all the same. And that hashkafa, or that philosophy, is very much reflected in the Seder HaYerusha, in how the assets are distributed. The Torah, on the other hand, has a very different view. Torah has a very different set of values, and that's why the halachic Seder HaYerusha is very different than what the legal defaults are. So let's begin. The first and most basic halacha is Yerusha flows to your sons. If a person has seven girls and one boy, the halacha is when he passes away, his son yarshins the entire estate. A girl is not a yorish if she has siblings, if there are sons. Now, if there are no sons, they're only daughters, then they will be the yarshin. They'll each divide it equally. But when there are sons, the son is a yorish, not the daughter. Grandchildren are not yarshin. So if a person passes away, his children are, and he's survived by his children and grandchildren, the grandchildren are not yarshin, they receive nothing. The assets all flow to the children. Now, if someone's son predeceases him, so in that situation, his share of the estate will flow to his yarshin. In that case, the grandchildren will get. But assuming the parents are alive, grandchildren are not yarshin. They are not part of the will. Now, we say the Yerusha goes to the males. Yerusha also flows through the male line, in the sense that while children, sons, yarshin a mother is not yarish her children. And when if a person dies without any yarshin, without any children, the Yerusha flows up the generations up to the deceased's father. If his father's no longer alive, then it goes up a generation, and then it spreads down to the father's yarshim, which means the deceased's brothers, or if his brothers are no longer alive, perhaps to his nephews, or if there are no nephews, to the nieces, depending on the situation. If there are no uncles, there are no brothers, there are no nephews, then Yerusha rises a generation. It goes to the grandfather, the paternal grandfather. Assuming he's not alive, it flows down to his yarshim, which means the deceased's cousin. Now, if a person has no close relatives, we will keep on going up a generation and then spreading to the yarshim. Every yid, if we go back far enough, we are all b'nei Avraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov. So at some point, every person has a yarish, regardless of how distant it may be. It may be hard to track them down, but that is how the general Seder HaYerusha works. Now, if someone has adopted children are not yorshim. And unless there is some sort of tzava or will or trust, an adopted child, even though he was treated as part of the family, and everything that was done by Chayim, he was treated the same as all the other children, at the end of the day, he is not a biological child, and Yerusha flows through to the biological children. Now, this is as far as children. When it comes to spouses, we have another halacha, which is not very well known. And that is that a husband yarshes his wife. If a married woman dies, the Yerusha does not flow to the children, it flows to her husband. However, this is not symmetrical. While a husband yarshes his wife, a wife is not yorish her husband. She is not a yorish. And if a person passes away and is survived by his wife, al pi halacha, the Yerusha flows to the children, not to the wife. Now, this sounds like, at first glance, it sounds like a woman would be left high and dry with no means of support. The reality is very different for two reasons. The first is, everyone knows there's something called a ksuba. Under the chuppah, you give your wife a ksuba, that in the case of a divorce, or in the case where if the husband dies, the wife is entitled to 200 zuz. 200 zuz, exactly how much that translates into modern dollars is a bit of debate. But one thing is clear. It's not a very substantial amount of money. That being said, there's another aspect of a ksuba. And that is, if in almana, a widow, if she does not claim the ksuba, if she does not claim the 200 zuz, she's entitled to support from the husband's estate. She's entitled to mezonos, she's entitled to food, she's entitled to dira, to live in the house, she's entitled to have avodim, or cleaning help in today's terms, and she's entitled to at least some of the medical bills for the inle kitzvah. So to a large degree, while she is not she does not yorish the assets, they do not belong to her, nevertheless, she has a claim against the estate for her support and maintenance until she dies or until she remarries. So as a matter of practice, an almana will never claim the Messiah as the 200 zuz for ksuba. She will always opt for this support, which ends up being much more substantial. So this takes care of her needs, but it doesn't change the halacha that she is not a yerush, which means she's entitled to support from the estate. But if she wants to start giving out gifts, Hanukkah gifts to her favorite Enoch, and start giving things away, she would not have the right to do that. Because she is not the Yorish, the underlying assets do not belong to her. Now this is what we'll call, in theory, this is the halach. Open up a Shulchan Aruch, and this would seem to be the result. The reality today is very different. And the reason it's different, not because halacha changes. Halacha does not change, Torah does not change, but the world around us does. And because of the way most people's finances are set up, the woman will end up with a large chunk of the estate, especially when you're dealing with more modest estates. And the reason for that is as follows. For many people, a large chunk of what they're leaving over is in the form of life insurance. Now, when you think about it, life insurance, it's not really an asset that the deceased owned and that now flows via Yerusha. When a person buys life insurance, he pays the premiums and he's essentially has a contract with this life insurance company. I'm going to pay you premiums, X amount of dollars per year. In exchange, you are going to pay my beneficiaries, my wife, my sons, my daughters, whoever the designated beneficiaries are, a death benefit after I die. So that death benefit was not money that the deceased owned that flows via Yerusha. This is a contract that he had with the life insurance company where the company committed to pay his beneficiary. So if the beneficiary is the wife, if it's the children, it's the daughters, whatever those designated beneficiaries are, they will be entitled to that death benefit, regardless of Hilchos Yerusha, because it is not something that flows via Yerusha. Now the next step is, and this is a bit of a, and this is really a bit of a chiddush. Many people, their bank accounts, certainly their personal bank accounts, are in joint accounts. They're under the both husband and wife's name. And very often, when you open the accounts, you opt in for its joint account with rights of survival. Now, arguably, in such a case, if you take money, even assuming it's the husband's money, he earned it, it's his, without going into the halachas of the Nechzei Yeshta, but if it's his money, when he puts it in the bank, what's he doing? He is essentially lending money to the bank, he's depositing with the bank, with the instructions, if I'm around, give it to me. If my wife survives me, I want you to pay back this debt, not to me, but to my wife. In that case, regardless of Hilchus Yerusha, you've given money to a bank, presumably who is not Jewish. You've told this bank, non-Jew, I'm lending it to you, pay it back to my wife. Arguably, that itself is a valid transfer, and those funds would not be subject to Hilchus Yerusha. That would pass over to the right to the survivor by operation of law, if you will, and it would not be subject to the Hilchus Yerusha. Your private house as well. Most people's houses are in their names and their wives' name. Unless, of course, there's some sort of liability or criminal issues. But yeah, that's the default in the United States is people will buy a house, they'll put it under both spouses' name. Now, what's really happening at that point is the house is now, it's a partnership. It's a shutzpitz between the husband and the wife. This comes up, unfortunately, very commonly in cases of divorce, where you have to divide the assets, and there are questions of who owns what belongs to who earned it, etc. But the house, assuming it's under both spouses' name, certainly the default assumption is belongs to both of them in a partnership. Which means the house, if the wife is on the deed, would even without Hilchus Yerusha, half the house is hers because it was essentially given to her when it was purchased, it was put under her name. And therefore, regardless of the fact that whether she is or is not a Yerush, she will end up with half of the house. So you end up with a situation where, although technically in halacha the wife is not a Yerush, nevertheless, in most cases, at least half the house will belong to her. She will probably be entitled to all of the assets in the joint accounts with rights of survival, and a life insurance policy where she's the designated beneficiary would be hers as well, without even coming on to Hilchus Yerusha. If that's the starting point, and on top of that we add the mezainos, essentially the full support that a woman is entitled to from the husband's estate until she claims the ksuba, so the bottom line is, the wife is very well taken care of under normal circumstances. Of course, again, it doesn't change the halacha. The Yerush is still the son's, and if the wife would like to start giving away gifts, she can give away the house, she can give away money that was in this joint account that's hers, but any of the personal belongings, she wants to start giving out some of the silver, zaydi shas, whatever it may be, those do not belong to her, and she would not have the right to give it away because she's not a yerush. Now the other, chiddush in Hilchus Yerusha, is the concept of a bukhar. Although the estate passes to a person's sons, it's not necessarily equal. If there is a bukhar, if the firstborn child was a boy, he's a bukhar, it has to be born naturally. If a child is born via C-section, he does not have the status of a bukhar. But assuming the first child is naturally born male, zahar, he's a bukhar, he's entitled to Pishnayim. He gets a double share of the estate, which means if there are three boys, we divide the estate into four parts. The Bechor gets two of those parts. The remaining two regular children get one. So you end up with Pishnayim. The Bechor gets twice as much as the regular children. Now this again is what it sounds like in Dina de Gemara, in Dina de Shulchan Aruch. In practice, because of the way that the world is set up today, this is much less relevant. And that is, there's an exception in the halachos of Pishnayim called Roy. a Bechor gets a double share of the assets that are in the father's possession at the time of his death. He has jewelry, he has diamonds, he has cash, he owns real estate. There, the Bechor is entitled to his double share, he gets his Kishnai. However, if it's Roy, if there's money owed to the father, it has to be collected. It's not in his hand. It's not in his possession. There is no pishnayim on those assets. Now, b'mei Chazal, this wasn't a big deal. How much of a person's assets were lent out? Finance was not a very Jewish career back then, because kesef tav ezami, a loan had to be interest-free. Charging interest was usur. So the bulk of a person's wealth was tied up in hard assets. So Roy was a fairly small exception. Today, every dime you have in the bank, if you think about it, when you put money in the bank, if it's in a safe deposit box, that's mufsik. That's in your possession. It's being held for you. There's an asset, there's a dollar that belongs to you. But if you deposit money into a bank account, essentially what you're doing is you're lending the bank money. It's payable upon demand. You can walk into the bank at any time and demand it back, and hopefully they'll be able to cover it. But nevertheless, it's a loan. It's a loan to a very secure debtor. It's a loan that's payable instantaneously, but it's not tachas yada. It's not in your possession. And therefore, according to many poskim, money that is in a bank, deposited in a bank account, the bechor will not get a pishnayim, will not get a double share of these assets. Now, to make things a little bit more interesting, or perhaps more complex, is this halacha may depend on which bank you use. Why? Because if you go to Chase, you deposit $10,000. So that $10,000 is a loan. It's a loan, it's Roy, no Kishan. What happens if you go to Bank Leumi? You go to IDB, you go to a Jewish bank. When you lend money to a Jewish bank, is that a loan? If it's a loan, we have a problem with ribbis. How can you collect interest? So again, you have Rav Moshe, corporations, but most of the Jewish banks will write a hetziriska when you borrow or lend from them. Now, if you've ever actually read through a hetziriska, what a hetziriska says is you're not lending money to the bank. It's a chatzimo v'chatzim v'kadoi. Half of the money is treated as a loan, half of it is pikadon. The bank is taking that and investing for it. It's your, they're holding onto your money. If it's a pikadon, so now what that means is, if we take this very literally, the chatzi nova, the half of the money that you deposit in the Jewish bank that's treated as a loan, that's roi. That's a debt. There's no pishnayim on that. On the other hand, the chelek ha-pikadon, the part that is not a, they're not lending to the bank, they're holding it as a pikadon in your behalf, that lechayr would be considered mufsik. If it's a shemer pikadon, a bechor will get a pishnayim. So you'll end up, the bechor will get a pishnayim on half of the money that's deposited in the Jewish bank, and no pishnayim on whatever is deposited in a goyish bank. Now, in truth, this analysis gets even more complex, because the money half the money deposited in the Jewish bank, we're saying half is a loan, no pishnayim. The half of it is a pikadon, where there is a pishnayim. What does the bank do with this pikadon? They're not holding it in cash sitting in your vault. They take it, they lend it out to someone else. So even if when you gave it to them it was a pikadon, when on your behalf they lend it to the next customer, at that point it became a halvah, it's back to Roy, there would be no pishnayim. But that's if they lend it to a goy. They lend it to a yid, then there's a hetziriska on that loan. So now you get there's a pishnayim on half of a half, or 25% of the loan. So you can imagine this analysis gets extremely complicated. Throw into the mix that some of the clients are Jewish, some of them are not Jewish. So there's this combination of hetziriskas and not hetziriskas. So you can just imagine someone goes to a dentayr, a bechor and a pashut. There's $100,000, three children. So the Bechor expects to get pishnayim, okay, divided by 4, I get 2, 50,000, 25 to each of the other siblings. The Bezdin, they end up giving the Bechor like $32,764.12. Everyone look at it like, what's this Bezdin doing? They can't, they're too drunk to hit the calculator keys. Just take, divide it and pishnayim, and that's it. But halacha very often in today's world is a lot more complicated than that, and some of these cheshbonos can be fairly complex and fairly difficult to really get to the bottom. So this is all the default Seder HaYerusha. Now, halacha lemaisa, if a person dies without a will, without a tzedakah, this is what is followed. And although people will fall around minho, dinu malchus sedina, and perhaps we'll spend a little more time on that later in this year, the bottom line is, according to Rav Poskim, the Seder HaYerusha is what will be followed. Which means, if a person does not write a will, he doesn't write a tzavah, and he passes away, he is leaving the entire family exposed. In halacha, his daughters are entitled to nothing. Legally, they'll be treated as equally the same as the boys. What you're doing is creating a tremendous tension in the family. The daughter, or perhaps the son-in-law, will be very tempted to say, I'm calling a lawyer, I'm enforcing my legal rights, I want my fair share. L'halacha, that is probably gezel, because l'halacha, it belongs to the boys. And it's still a similar dynamic, there's a bachar, the bachar is tied to pishnayim. There's no way we don't do away with any halachas. This is what would be followed if there is no will or tzavah. And if a person doesn't do any estate planning, he's creating, again, a tremendous nisayon. Whoever will do better off in court than in this default Seder HaYerusha is going to have a very difficult nisayon. I will tell you, firsthand, not everyone is able to withstand this nisayon. And putting family in this situation can totally and completely destroy the family. People spend many years of their life, especially if they're successful. They reach a point earlier in their career where it's not about them anymore. There's only so much a person can eat. And for people who spend years or decades working for their children, for their grandchildren, to ensure that they're cared for. But without proper planning, every dime that you've earned for them is just creating a bigger misayim, it's creating a bigger machlokes, and I can't stress how important it is for a person to do some level of planning. But this leads us to one of the great questions in estate planning. We've just gone through the Seder HaYerusha. We've just discussed what happens when there is no will. But is that all the Seder HaYerusha is? Is Seder HaYerusha nothing more than what happens if someone is too lazy to write a will? Or is it perhaps more than that? Perhaps the Torah is telling us this is the correct way to divide your assets. There's a fascinating Ramah, brings down a Mordechai, that has the following, describes the following scenario. A woman, on her deathbed, called in her friend. She handed her a sack of gold and said, do with this the best thing, and promptly died. So this friend was sitting there holding a sack of gold and went to her Rav. What do I do with this money? So, if they came to you, what would you respond? Donate it to the center of Chesed in Chicago, your yeshiva, find a good organization, Hegdish, find a good mitzvah and do it with the funds. Let the Mordechai know. You know what you should do with it? Open up a chumash, read the Seder HaYerusha, and distribute the assets based on the Torah's formula. And the reason for that is, if that wasn't the best thing to do with the money, the Torah would say, when a person dies, kayim comes, takes it all to Hekdesh. The Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says it goes to the Yerushim with this Seder HaYerusha, with this distribution scheme. That is what the Torah wants. Okay, so this is a mitzvah. This is a madrega. Mishnah Bava Basra says even bigger fish. Mishnah Bava Basra says that that if a person goes ahead and he takes away the Yerusha from his son, and he writes it to someone else. Masha also, if he did it, it's done. It's effective. A person has the ability to go ahead and to distribute his assets differently. But it's ein ruach hachav menoichin menu. Chazal are not happy with your actions, this is not the appropriate thing to do. And it's Allah who reshes in Shulchan Aruch that Aburi Achsanta to go ahead and deprive a Yorish of the Yerusha is asr. Now this leads us to some pretty serious questions. And by a show of hands, how many people here who have written a will have exactly followed the Seder HaYerusha? Anybody? Okay, so I should start with, how many people have written a will? Okay, good. Should be more, but good. Good start. I've seen hundreds of wills. I have never seen anyone follow the Seder HaYerusha exactly. And the great question is, we have a Mishnah that's saying that it's Aser. We have a Mordechai saying that that's the appropriate thing to do. So what in the world is going on? So here we have, the Tzitz brings down an Eter that has a tremendous fish. Zafti Eter, when the Mishnah says you cannot cut out your Yairish, it's talking about completely disinheriting it. Giving the child nothing. That is us. However, Zafti Eter, if you leave if the Yairish gets a share of the estate, you want to give it to him. You're not interested, you're not cutting him out. You just don't want him to get the entire amount. You want to reduce the share, or you want to share it with other people. Zakti Itzur, that is going to be mutter. The Isser is only when you completely disinherit a child. Now, Halakha L'maisa, I mean, this is a machlokes. Some places can, many places can follow the Itzur. Others reject it. The Samsayfer has a bit of a middle ground. He says you have a good justification, there's a divine mitzvah, there's a noble purpose, if you will, to go ahead and change the Seder HaYerusha, then it's okay. On the other hand, just to do it for no good reason, he says, would still be aser. It's a machlokes. But one thing is clear. To cut out a Yerush completely, l'kulei alma, is going to be aser. Now, some of the most difficult conversations and phone calls any Rav gets when a Ger Hokus Yerusha is, when a parent wants to cut out a child, there's always a tragic backstory behind it. There's obviously a tremendous amount of hurt and pain. But Halakha L'maisa is, even though the relationship is not good, even if the child is not doing a kind of kibbut av the aim appropriately, nevertheless, there still is an isser of Aburei Achsanta of completely cutting out a child. I actually wrote a kuntres on summarizing Hilchos Yerusha. So I put it out, it was quite a number of years ago. And when it went out, it was a law firm posted on a website. And the next few weeks, my phone was literally ringing off the hook. And the phone calls were all the same. Phone calls were all about how I'm an older person, I haven't spoken to my child in decades, I've never seen my Einoko, I want to cut them out of the will, I could do it, I can't do it, I want to make sure it's being done correctly. Halakha L'maisa, there is no hetzer. And again, it's the pain, the agus nefesh is unspeakable, but halakha is the halakha, to completely cut out a yorish is going to be awesome. Remember at the time thinking to myself that like wow, am I the only one that talks to my parents? And everyone calling was the same Shiloh. I realized that you don't call a random Rav who wrote a kuntres on Hilchos Yerusha unless there's something very weighty that's on your mind that you want to make sure everything is done right and no way to challenge it. So there's a certain selection bias, if you will. Baruch Hashem, this is not that common. But to cut out a child, to cut out a yorish is awesome. Now this is a painful and extreme case, but there's a good chance every single person in this room who has a will may have been over the system. Because let's go back. Many wills say, between a husband and wife, that, it's called the I love you wills, that if whichever spouse survives the other one gets the entire estate. When the second to die spouse dies, at that point it gets divided to the children. Now, if a husband dies first, al pi halacha, who's the others? The sons. So again, the wife is taken care of. That was the beginning of this year. A standard will says what? If the wife survives the husband, everything goes to her. This is connected to the first mishnah, because you are being madar achzah, the Yerusha. Now it's true when eventually when the second dies, when the wife dies, at that point it'll flow to the Yarshim. That could be years or decades later.
She could remarry.
What?
She could remarry.
And it could all go to the that's true. So this is a very common concern. And really what a person should do is make sure that in all circumstances the Yarshim are getting at least something. Most people are samech on the Yitzer, as long as you leave something to the Yarshim, we're noyeh to do it whatever you want with the rest. But make sure that if your wife survives you, some amount goes right away to the Yarshim following the Seder Hayush. Now the great question is, how much do you have to leave? How much has to go how much do you have to leave to the Yarshim? How much can you distribute as you see fit? So the Yitzer says, Dala Zuhu. So in your right, it's Savoy, just write Dal Zuhub into the sons, do what you want with the rest. Question of what is Dal Zuhub? So this is not clear among the Moishim. There are actually, the Gers Moishe has three shuvas about the matter. And he deals with specific cases. In one case, he tells the person to leave one-fifth of the estate to the sons, to the Yarshim, do what you want with the rest. In another shuva, he says, leave your house to the Yarshim and distribute the rest of your assets as you see fit. In the third shuva, he writes, give $1,000 to the Yarshim and distribute the rest as you see fit. So we have 20% of the estate, we have $1,000, and we have the house. What's the tzad hashava? I have no idea. It's hard to know without knowing the size of the estates, and again, we don't know the details behind it, but one thing is clear. It has to be something that has a certain kashyus. Leaving each of rights, leaving a quarter of a zuz, you leave someone 25 cents, that's nothing. That's not considered a yerusha. It has to be an amount that has some level of kashivas. It should be an amount that people will not actually fight about, but should it have episode kashivas. And at one point, I was writing a tzavah for an estate. It was worth a few $100 million. And the question that I went to a few rabbanim, how big should the carve-out be? And at that point, this is going back probably about 12 years ago, the consensus was, even if you're worth $1 billion, $10,000 is considered money. You know, you don't just drop $10,000 without thinking. Again, today's generation, I don't know if that's true anymore. But at least back then, the old guard, that was considered money. And regardless of the size of the estate, that was considered epis a carve-out. It was actually interesting because I went back to the person and I told him, you know, we have to change the wills, we have to create this carve-out. He said, $10,000, my lawyer's going to charge me more than that to put in this clause. So what compromise that we came up with, and this is actually an Eitz HaTayva, is instead of changing the whole will and trust and all the complications, he wrote in as a codicil that his personal belongings, you know, in this case, I think he left his cars to his Yarshim. That way, it's not in the will itself. You don't have to go ahead and redo the whole plan. And, you know, the cars had value, you know, well, in excess of $10,000. That's how he addressed it. And again, very often, that's where it's put in the personal effects, because it doesn't change the whole, you know, the whole complex scheme. So, Halach L'maaseh is, again, to completely cut out of Yarish is going to be awesome. If you're going to leave the Yarshim something and you're going to redistribute it, that is a machlokes. Certainly, if it's being done for a Dvar Mitzvah, it's mutter. Today, virtually everyone takes care of their wives and gives a direct Yerusha to the wife, and it's appropriate. Because although the default in Halacha is they have support from the estate, today, having the wife go to the children and making claims against the estate for these monies is very awkward. We don't have a bezin today that can really manage the process, if you will, and make sure she gets what she's entitled to. And therefore, it certainly makes sense. When we see Chazal, we're concerned about her well-being. If a person wants to give her a share of Yerusha to make sure she's taken care of, that certainly is an appropriate reason to be sendech on the Yitzer. Daughters as well. Although a daughter is not a Yerush, and Chazanish writes very strongly that people who wanted to give the daughters treatment the same as their sons because of the spirit of equality, Zinish writes, that's kfir. We follow halacha, And we have not bought into modern Western, you know, philosophy. We follow the halacha. Nevertheless, for hundreds of years, daughters were given a share. It initially was a chatzi zachar, a half a share of a zachar, and the reason for that was it was essentially in place of a dowry. People, when they got married, literally under the chuppah, they would write a shtar chatzi zachar, which is essentially in a will, if you will, or an estate planning document. They couldn't afford to give a dowry to son-in-law in cash. Instead, they gave it at the back end. They gave them a share of the Yerusha. Today, people are a little bit more diplomatic. They don't demand this under the chuppah, but there is an expectation. There's an expectation that that will come. And if a person decides they'd like to take a chumrah, not be sadech on the eater, and do follow the state of Yerusha completely, cut out your son-in-law, there probably will be hand grenades thrown at your keter. And it's not a good idea. It'll cause machoikis, it'll destroy the family, and therefore we have an eater, the oilim is slaymach on the eater, and that certainly is the appropriate approach. Now that being said, although lahalacha a person can tinker, he can modify the Seder HaYerusha, if a person wants to give one child more than the other, you have to exercise extreme caution. The Gemara says, "Va'olam al yishana v'ven ben avanim." You should treat all of your sons equally. You shouldn't make any distinction between them. And the Gemara says, "We see what happened." The Gemara's riot to this, an example is Yosef Hatzadik, because Yaakov Avinu gave Yosef Hatzadik Ksenas Hasan an extra coat, not grace of gels. We're not talking about, you know, a couple of chain of nursing homes. What happened? What happened was a tragedy, and Klal Yisrael ended up in Golos Mitzrayim. Now, very often people say, no, my Yankala, my children, they would never fight. The mashal that's given are the shiftei kah. The example given is, the extra was given to who? To Yosef HaTzadik. And still, it was deserved, it was well deserved, it was given with a cheshbon, it was appropriate, everyone was tzadikim. And still, this is the result. So, Yankel, Shlomi, Rachel, they're all wonderful, they're all great. You did a wonderful job, you mechanech them. But when the Gemara says, lo'olam al yishana, lo'olam is a pretty broad statement, and you have to be very, very careful before you go ahead and decide to be more clever. And there are cases where there's no choice. Sometimes you'll have one particular child is struggling, has a special need, where there is room to say that, okay, he needs it more. But even so, you have to be careful. I've dealt with many situations where a more successful child understands and is very happy that he doesn't need it and appreciates the fact that the father is taking care of the one that needs it more. I've seen cases where a person says, and the settler says, because my brother's a shlamazel, I have to lose out on my Yerusha. So there are all types. You have to have a very realistic sense of who your children are, the relationship between them, and you again, lo'olam al yishana is you have to be very careful when you're ignoring that. And it's telling you very often is to help out mechayim. If a child needs help and you do a mechayim, it's much more difficult for the remaining children to be resentful or to have time later on. So we've so far addressed two major points. What the default state of Yerusha is and whether you're allowed to tinker with it. Let's discuss briefly how to change it. What needs to be done if a person does not want to follow the regular state of Yerusha? Now, the simplest thing is call your attorney. Draft a will. The problem with that is a fewfold. In general, if you want to transfer something, everyone knows you need a ma'aseh kinyan. Mishicha, hagbah, chazaka, kesef. You have to make a kinyan. And you can only transfer something when it belongs to you. You can't sell something that you don't own yet. You can't sell something or transfer something that you no longer own. A will, even if one were to say it is a shtar kinyan, we should recognize it because of Dina Malchus, so we should allow it to transfer assets. The problem is, when does a will take effect? After a person dies. The moment a person dies, what happens to his estate? It flows, la halacha, to the yorshim. By the time the will kicks in, the assets are no longer his to give away. And therefore, most places can say, a will is not a valid kinyan. Now, the Gris Moshe has a fiddish, he says it happens b'shas nisa, and he says it will be a kinyan, and Rav Moshe was Rav Moshe, but it's a fiddish. Right place can hold, it cannot be a kinyan, because it's too late. Okay, so forget the kinyan. The father says, this is what I want to happen. Keep it out in. We should force the children to follow the wishes, because the father made it very clear that's what he wants. Okay. But when the father tells the child to clean up his room, does Destin come in with a whip and start forcing the child to listen? Perhaps we'd like them to, but they don't. Keep it out of aim is a mitzvah. Destin doesn't force a child to listen to his parents. So even if there is a keep it out of aim and it's the right thing for a child to do, if he chooses not to, it's not something that can necessarily be enforced. Kveger points out a lomdusha problem as well. Kibarav is Mishalav. The father wants a child to drive him to the airport. The child has to take off the time and give him the ride, but he can ask his father to pay for the gas. The expenses are on the father. When a person says, Al Kibarav, this is what you should do with the estate, is that Mishalav or Mishal Ben? Essentially, he's saying, after I die, and after it's yours, give it to your sister. That's not Mishalav. And therefore, it's debatable whether Kibarav applies Bavav. There is another concept of Mitzvah of the Rav Meis, which means that a person gives instructions about how his assets should be distributed. If he instructs his Yarshim what to do, there are cases where there's a special mitzvah where it's enforceable. However, Shulchan Aruch Paskins, Mitzvah of the Rav Meis applies only when you're Hoshesh Bekach. When you escrow money by a third party and say, here's the money, after I'm gone, give it, this is what I want done with it. Mitzvah Chaim Dibrei HaMeis will honor those instructions. But if they're not escrowed by a third party, and certainly the instructions are not given directly to the Yarshim, this mitzvah does not apply. So in a very technical sense, a will, it's highly questionable whether a will is an effective way to change the Seder HaYerush. Now, Midei Sveika Loi Nafka, the Gris Moshe we mentioned has a chiddush, he holds it's a kinyan. The Achiezer says, even though a will doesn't meet the strict requirements of Mitzvah Chaim Dibrei HaMeis, nevertheless, because that is the law, people are saying das, he says Mitzvah Chaim Dibrei HaMeis will apply. And therefore, halacha l'maisa, if a person has a will and he passes away and the children ask a rav, what should I do? The rav will tell them, follow the will. Because you have Rav Moshe, you have the Achiezer, and you have many shittas, they'll be the mitzvah of kibarav, regardless of whether it's enforceable or not. On the other hand, if a child says it's not interested, he doesn't want to do the right thing, he's only going to do it if he's forced by a Beis Din, whether a Beis Din will enforce a will when it's not written in the halacha, is already an open question. It will depend on the Beis Din. And one of the challenges is that if in such situations, each child will start do a little venue shopping, try to figure out which rug goes to the Rebbeisha, which one goes to the Achiezer, which one goes like this, and you end up with a terrible stalemate before you even get the matter in front of the Beis Din. Now, the way to ensure that a will is followed is what's known as a shtar chatzi zachar. I'm going to just go through it very briefly because we're running out of time, but essentially the way a shtar chatzi zachar works is as follows. Person has an estate that's worth $1 million. He has a son and a daughter. In halacha, what would happen when he passes? All goes to the son, daughter gets nothing. What a person, a person writes a document and says as follows. Number one, a person says, I owe my daughter $1 million. Or $700,000. Number two, if my son voluntarily follows the instructions in my will and in my trust, then this debt is null and void. In other words, you created a debt on yourself, but there's a tznah. So if the son voluntarily follows what it says in the will and the trust, and he gives his daughter, his sister, half of the estate, $500,000, then this debt is null and void. It's meaningless, we rip it up, everyone goes home happy. Masha'ekin, if the son decides to stand on his rights, the son comes to Bezdin and says, I don't care what Tati wanted. I am the Yerush that belongs to me. I'm not going with the Achiezer. I'm not going with the Ramosha. Mine. So Bezdin, if they're inclined to ignore, to pass them like that, will say, fine. You're entitled to it. You're the Yerush. But wait a second. There's a Shtar Chayiv that your father owed your sister $700,000. So we're going to collect this $700,000 and give it to your sister. So the idea, the son, when he sees this document, will pull out his calculator and realize he's better off following the instructions and the will and the trust, even if they're halacha not enforceable. That's better for him than having this choyv, this debt, kick in, which will wipe out a much bigger share of his yerusha. So you have a situation where, technically speaking, the son is still the yerusha. But there's this big stick, if you will, forcing the son to follow the wishes of the will, of the trust. Again, these documents generally refer back to all of the estate planning documents. They're pretty broad. And this is how, sort of like a backdoor way to make sure the wishes are followed, even if technically it's not done with the appropriate kinyan. Now, when it comes to trusts are a little bit more complex. A revocable trust in halacha is probably the equivalent of a will, and therefore, according to Rav Moshe and the Achiezer, it would probably be enforceable. The ones that argue would probably reject that. An irrevocable trust, if you think about it, an irrevocable trust is really a kinyan almanach lahakness. At the time the settlor or the grantor transfers money to the trustee, he's giving it away. He has no control, he has no rights to this. All he gets out of it is he usually picks up the income tax. But if he's given it away, it's no longer his, then it's no longer part of the estate for halacha purposes. It's a kin amanach lahaknos, and therefore, this misvara, it would seem that if a person puts money in an irrevocable trust, that should be enforceable in halacha, regardless of this entire conversation. Again, it's still advisable to do a shtar chatzis zocher because there's no precedent. Trusts did not exist b'mei Chazal. It's a nice svara that's a kinyan amanach lahaknos, but since it's untested, you probably shouldn't rely on it. On top of that, people put money in a trust. Sometimes it's not really intended to, it doesn't really completely give up control. It may be on paper like that, but the reality might be he's retained control and they figure out what to do. In which case, again, you're on shakier ground and it's kedai to do a shtar chatzis zocher. In conclusion, I'd like to just go through a few moments, some practical tips and advice when a person about estate planning. The first takeaway is do something. Get something in place. Even if it's not perfect, even if it's only a legal will, not have something. Many people are paralyzed when it comes to estate planning, because they're thinking ahead, what will be next year, what will be in a decade, what will be in two decades, what will be with the next generation. They're trying to anticipate everything that could happen, all the contingencies. And until they find that perfect estate plan, they do nothing. It's a tragic mistake. It's a tragic mistake because if you delay it too long and you pass away with nothing, there is no tzava I have ever seen that's worse for the family than doing nothing and allow chaos. Get something in play. You want to modify it for the next 40 years, redo it every 2 weeks, go ahead and do that. But get something in place for now. And a person also has to realize that there comes a time in life where you have to give up control. Even when a person is alive and healthy. Our children have their own bechira. They make their own decisions, they make their own choices, sometimes wise, sometimes unwise. But they have their own bechira. And when a child is young and at home, there's a chiyuv chinuch, they're responsible for everything they do, there comes a point where you have to let go. You're not chanuch your children in the grave. You shouldn't be controlling exactly how they run their lives. And make sure, again, get something in place, some sort of, even if it's not perfect, have some sort of plan that children know what's going to happen. The second point is, avoid surprises. People very often, children have expectations. And perhaps the greatest recipe or cause of machlokes is when children walk around with certain assumptions, the child that's running the business is sure Achamei Vashmi will be completely his. Another child may be convinced that the house they're living in will become theirs. People have expectations, people have ideas. If the time they realize that you have other plans are after the shiva when they're in the lawyer's office, it doesn't always go over so well. People may have made plans based on their assumptions, and just the shock and the surprise will lead them to accuse their siblings of undue influence, of maneuvering things. Let them know what's happening. Like if everyone's being treated equally, then you're safe. But if there are going to be any dashed expectations, let them know now. Have that difficult conversation. It may be difficult, but it's a lot easier than what your family will go through if you're not going to face up to that difficulty. Another important point is don't retain control when it's too late. People get older. And the fact of the matter is, as you get older, you get weaker. And you reach a point, no matter how tough and how strong a person is, as he gets older, he loses that toughness, he loses that independence. And if a person has control of his assets until an advanced age, very often he's in a situation where he has to come onto a child, he may move into a child's house, and it becomes very difficult when a child starts badgering and pressuring an elderly parent. I need the money, I'm taking care of you, the uncle doesn't need it anyway. It's very hard to resist. And one of the most common machlokes in estate planning is when the plans change when a parent is in an advanced age, there's a tremendous amount of accusations, and it's a very difficult question. Because parents can change their minds, and what halachic incompetence is, and what legal incompetence is, and undue influence, and all these terms, halacha and law have very different outlooks. And it can be a tragedy in the family. The father had Alzheimer's, he had Das, he didn't have Das. It's important for a person, before we get to that stage, have the money in a trust where it's controlled by a trustee, someone who you can rely on, someone who's not subject to these kind of pressures, and that could also avoid a tremendous amount of agas nefesh, and I'll focus later on. I'd like to end with a story. It's a true story, one of the most disturbing stories that I've been involved with. The story goes back about 10 years. There was a Yerushalayim. Now, I will tell you, a Yerushalayim, although we hear the outliers, every story that happens is a tragedy, the good news is that 99% of cases are settled, b'shalom, amicably, everyone figures it out. This is one of those 1%. It was a fight between 4 siblings, one of them felt he didn't get what he was entitled to, and it was a real machlokes, it was fairly nasty. Ultimately, this child, who felt wronged, did prevail. And he won a decent amount of money. It wasn't the life-changing amount, but it was an award. And throughout the process, he had involved, he needed help. He himself was not a young man. He had needed help. His children were involved in helping him prepare, etc. About 5 or 6 years later, this fellow who won the Dintaira came to me. Now, he, of course, knew, since he won the Dintaira, that I must have been the most brilliant guy around. So he comes, and it came, he was thinking about his estate planning, he was thinking about what happened in Achamei Vashem, and he brought with him his entire family, all of his children, and they started the conversation, what will be, he had a business, what's going to be, who's going to, what everyone's role is, what everyone's ownership was going to be. And it wasn't a long meeting, but it was very clear from the beginning, each of the children was maneuvering to make sure to grab what they can. Each of the children was positioning so that Achamei Vashem would be able to pounce. They each had already engaged attorneys without telling anybody to guide them and advise them how to set things up. And when we finished the meeting, and the father turns to me and says, so can you draft a shtar and that will protect the family, that will avoid machlokes? My answer was, I can't. My answer was, your children were well trained. When you went and fought with your siblings, your children were there. The lesson they learned was not about yashrus, it wasn't about mishpat, it wasn't about emes. The lesson that they saw was, you fight over every dollar. The lesson that they learned was that money comes before shalom. The lesson they learned was, grab what you can, do it to them before they do it to you. There's no shtar a dying can write that can undo 70 years of bad chinuch. And there was really nothing to do in this situation. It was too far gone. There was nothing to be done. But on the flip side, if a person throughout his life, in his words, and even more so in his actions, demonstrates to himself, to his children, to his family, that money isn't everything. If the children see in him that he's willing to leave money on the table, he's willing to walk away to avoid machlokes, he doesn't want people to have tainus on them. So then, write your shtar, do your estate planning, you have to do shtabas. But in all likelihood, everything will be okay. And besides for the assets you've left them, if these are the lessons and the values that you've instilled, you've left them with a legacy more valuable than gold and silver. Thank you.